prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we discuss underseen horror movies, specifically those which have fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
I'm Lance.
But this month we are actually not following that rule because it is No Rules November. And that means that we are picking pretty much anything that we want. It doesn't have to have fewer than 1,000 views. And this gives us a chance to talk about some of our other favorite movies. But we're still kind of treading on Unsung Horrors territory. We're not doing anything mainstream, you know.
Yeah. My neck, I know there's something about Mary. I was going to pick that, but
right,
we're sticking with horror still.
Yes. Still doing horror, but you won't find us talking about Halloween, Freddy, Jason, any of that stuff. So my pick for No Rules November this year is The Blood-Spattered Bride from 1972.
Mircalla Karstein.
Is that the woman in the portrait? How did she die?
She didn't die. She was found spattered with blood, wearing a wedding gown, next to the body of her husband. She killed her husband on the wedding night.
Why?
It was because he tried to make her do unspeakable things. Look, only the birth date is given. They waited for 2 years before they decided to bury her. But they never managed to take the dagger away from her hand.
There exists in the human female an undeniable aggressive tendency when she is eventually confronted with the loss of her virginity.
I think you like it when he hurts you. I don't love you. I hate you.
It is by no means uncommon in dreams to have thoughts of hatred and desires of revenge and death directed at the persons for whom in real life we feel the greatest affection.
Kill him! Kill him now! Get closer to him, slash his face! Find his heart and cut it out!
This has a Mondo Macabro Blu-ray and is currently available to stream on Tubi.
That's where I watched it, was Tubi.
Okay.
I need to get that release, though.
It is really good. I definitely recommend it. It's got a great commentary with Sam Deegan and Kat Ellinger, and it really helped give a lot of the sort of historical and political context to the film, which was exactly what I needed from this because, mm-hmm. like, yeah, I know who Franco is. I know he's a shit. And but, you know, putting those two elements together and really talking about all of the themes in his film and how specifically this was a reaction to what was going on in Spain at the time was really helpful to have from them.
Right. That's why I'd love to listen to it. Cause I did read a little background from Aranda's script that, you know, and he pulled those elements from that Francoist dictatorship,
yeah.
And how it's like an allegorical rejection of that fascism and the oppression that women were going through and so many others. So,
right.
Yeah. I want to hear Sam and Kat's.
It's good stuff.
Good stuff.
Highly recommended. So let's get into some of the film specifics. This was directed by Vicente Aranda. He was a renowned Spanish filmmaker. He was a founding member of the Barcelona School of Film. And a lot of his films, including this one that we're going to be talking about, dealt with themes of feminism and had female leads in them. We already mentioned Franco as just a quick reminder for folks. He was the military dictator from 1939 to 1975. It was an era of repression, authority, conservatism, the patriarchal society, fascism, very Catholicism driven. It was an era when divorce was illegal. There was no access to contraception. So really not a great time for women. So it's really refreshing to have a director who's tackling themes like this in his films and finding a way to get them made in an era like this, especially.
Yeah.
And something I thought that was interesting that came up in the commentary was that if you were living in Spain and you wanted to see a film that was made in America, if it was brought over, the version that you were going to see was one that the regime had gotten a hold of first and then dubbed it over to sort of fit with Franco's messaging. So you probably saw a completely different film than the original. That one.
Yeah, it's terrible. And wild stuff.
Yeah. Aranda has a number of films. I've dipped into a few of them. One of them I've previously seen was called Exquisite Cadaver. I've brought that up on the podcast before, from 1969. And another one that I just watched, but I'm going to revisit because it's not an October watch. It's very surreal. And I tried watching it in the morning, and that was just the wrong time for it. And that's Left-Handed Fate, also known as Fata Morgana, from 1966. That's currently on the Cave of Forgotten Films. It's under the Giallo section, which I guess fits, but it's a little more on the odd side, and more maybe even like Giulio Questi, Death Laid an Egg side of Giallo, but even more so, like taken to the next level of surreal and weird.
I'm sold.
I figured you would be. So Left-Handed Fate is about a young model who decides to stay in a town that's being evacuated. She gets warned by a blind man that she's going to be murdered that day. And so she starts getting worried about that. Not everyone in town is gone, though. There are still a few other characters who've remained because she needs other people to interact with. Even though it would have been kind of cool to just be like two characters, like an entirely abandoned city. But, you know, I didn't make the movie. I'm not questioning his decision. So, but what was interesting too is that when you get about halfway or 30 minutes into this movie, it adds this Minority Report level to it, where there's this conversation between two men and they're discussing her murder that's going to happen. Like, they already know about it and where it's going to happen. So yeah, there's this other weird that got introduced, and I was like, oh, whoa, this is turning into a whole other movie. There's a scene where they're showing crime scene photos of all these other victims in the past, because apparently the town vacates at least once a decade, because this takes place in the 60s. And they mention, you know, other years in the 50s and the 40s of people like, oh, did you leave in 1943? No, I stayed, and that kind of thing. It's weird. It's
interesting. They vacate because of like murders are happening, or it's not really explained.
They don't really explain it. That could be the reason. I don't know. It's an odd one, but I did enjoy what I saw, but I was also not in the right frame of mind for watching that kind of movie at the time. So right. It's definitely one to revisit at a later time. So Aranda also was the screenwriter for the film, and he adapted the novella Carmilla. I read this a few years ago. I didn't revisit it for this, but Lance, you just read it recently. Yeah,
I did. Yeah. And it's a lot of fun. Cause I watched it after I watched Blood Spattered Bride. So I saw a lot of the elements that Aranda pulled from this, the novella, but I also was reminded of Crypt of the Vampire, yeah. Alucarda, Vampire Lovers. Vampire, yeah.
Yeah.
So many good stuff.
There's a lot of good ones, and maybe one of those will come up in our double feature picks.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. I think we'll be talking about one of those or a few of those later.
Yeah. All right. So the score, Antonio Perez Olea. He also did Fata Morgana. He did the score for The Unseen's Woods from 1970, which I watched for Horror Gives Back. So I'll be talking about that in our next episode.
Nice.
That was my in memoriam pick because John Steiner is in it.
Mm.
Good man. Olea also did the score for A Candle for the Devil from 1973, which has been on my watch list forever. And multiple people have recommended it, and I appreciate all of you, but I just have not gotten to it yet, folks. I'm sorry. I will.
So many movies to watch.
There are so many. Cinematography is by Fernando Arribas. He also did Cannibal Apocalypse by Antonio Margheriti, Death Walks at Midnight and Death Walks on High Heels, Exquisite Cadaver, The Coming of Sin by Jose Larraz. And one I know you've watched this. I can't remember if it was for Junesploitation, though. Day of the Assassin, 1979. Chuck Connors, Fred Williamson.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Oh, did I catch you off guard?
Well, that's a cinema. I mean, isn't that like a po' boy type thing? Like that. Mm-hmm. That's a po' boy production. Did Fred Williamson, he directed that one, didn't he? Wow. I mean, that's, yeah.
It's all connected, folks.
It is. I mean, anything Fred Williamson's involved in, I mean, it turns a lot of people off, I think. But geez, I'm sold. And now I'm like really into the cinematographer. Arribas, you go, man.
Yeah. So one other thing I did want to bring up is regarding the distribution of it. So when this came to the States, it was double featured with I Dismember Mama, which is the most ill-fitting double feature you can possibly imagine. So Lance, I know you're probably familiar with the ad for this though, because it plays a lot at Alamo Drafthouse, especially for like Terror Tuesday or any sort of horror movie pre-show, mm-hmm. where there's a guy outside the theater interviewing people who are coming out.
Right.
And, you know, part of the gimmick of this double feature was an Upchuck cup. So that was part of that. The best part of that, though, is when there's this one guy, I think he's got glasses and like kind of like curly, froey hair. And he's like, the reporter's like, sir, can you tell me about the movie you just saw? And the guy starts laughing like, it's the best thing ever.
This is Howard Scott on the scene for TV 12. We're at the Bijou Theater, where it's been reported that a man has gone berserk while watching a double feature horror program. You, sir, excuse me, what did you think of what happened inside? Sir, did you like the movie?
But that's my favorite thing about this. It's an odd choice for a double feature, but I mean, that's kind of how they did double features back then, is like the movies had nothing to do with one another. It was like they happened to be coming out at the same time, so let's just stick them together. All right, so getting into the cast, the star of the film is Marisa Mirabal. She's Susan, or the bride, in this. She was also in The House That Screamed from 1969, directed by the same director of Who Can Kill a Child, best Spanish horror movie on the planet ever. No contest. Lance's favorite, and I can't believe this might be Lance's double feature pick, guys.
Bell from Hell.
Yep.
Yes, so good. I've talked about this on a couple of episodes.
I think we're at 10 now.
At 10, okay. Yeah, that was directed by Claudio Guerin, who passed away during the filming of it, which we've talked about, and then finished by Juan Antonio Bardem, who did Corruption of Chris Miller and Death of a Cyclist. Love that movie. Love Maribel Martin too.
So. Anytime for Lance to bring up Bell from Hell. Like that's, folks, that's literally why I picked this movie for No Rules November, was so that Lance would have a chance to talk about Bell from Hell again.
Yeah. I mean, that's all I got right now for it. Okay. We've talked about it enough, but maybe it'll be my No Rules pick.
There you go. She was also in a movie called The Holy Innocents from 1984, which I've always been interested to watch, and I went back and looked and read at some of the reviews, and it pretty much every review said rich people are the fucking worst and this movie is depressing. So I'm definitely going to have to be in the right mood to watch that one if I do. So starring as Carmilla is Alexandra Bastedo. She starred in a lot of TV and film. She was in Casino Royale from 1967 and The Ghoul, starring Peter Cushing, directed by the great Freddie Francis.
The Ghoul.
Who we'll be talking about next week. In our Horror Gives Back episode. I'm going to keep plugging that. There's a little girl in this called Carol. She's played by Rosa Rodriguez. I bring her up because we'll talk about her, especially when we get to the ending.
Yeah, she's a fantastic character.
And then last and certainly least, because men are the worst in this.
All the men in this are the worst.
Yeah, that comes up a lot in the movies that we cover, but, you know, it is what it is. So, the best part about this is that the husband doesn't get a name. He is simply him or he or L in the Spanish credits.
I mean, it's very interesting because none of the men have names in this.
This is true. Yeah.
There's a doctor. There's like a caretaker.
There's a caretaker,
like
too.
Servant. And they're not given names. I mean, they don't need names. They're men.
Yep.
In this movie, they're men.
Exactly.
And that's a terrible thing.
Yeah. In this movie, if you're a man, you're the worst.
I mean, not just the movie. This movie. Men are terrible.
You're going to get your dick shot off, guys. Just saying.
Night of the Demon. Get it ripped off.
So he's played by Simon Andrew. He's also in Beyond Reanimator, Flesh and Blood, Verhoeven's medieval movie that's got some plague-infested flesh flinging going on in that movie. I love that movie. Mm. Night of the Sorcerers, which I think we've brought up on the episode before because it's directed by Amando De Osorio and covered Demon Witch Child. Mm-hmm. So probably brought it up then. He was also in Death Walks at Midnight and On High Heels, Forbidden Photos of a Lady Above Suspicion. And then there was two that I saw on his filmography that I didn't watch yet, but I put on my watch list because they sound really interesting. There's one called Crystal Heart from 1986, starring Tawny Katane. It's about a 22-year-old man who has lived inside of a crystal room because of his rare illness. He meets an up-and-coming rock star. I'm assuming that's Tawny Katane. And they fall in love. So it sounds like a better version of Boy in the Plastic Bubble.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Yeah. And then the other one that I want to watch, he's in a movie called Fight to the Death from 1975. And Lance, if you look that up and you see the poster, you'll understand why I want to see this.
Fight to the Death, 1975. Oh, yeah. That is a very hairy, bare-chested John Saxon.
Mm-hmm.
Looking very tan and great. Like a fucking Tommy gun.
Yeah. I mean, that's just the sexiest thing I've ever seen in my life. So yeah, definitely going to be watching Fight to the Death pretty soon.
Nice.
All right. So that is it for the cast and crew. We'll get more into this film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so before we get into the film, just a quick summary of it. So we have a young newlywed, Susan, and the film literally opens with her in her wedding dress driving with her new husband to a hotel. After the hotel, they go to his family mansion to go live, and she begins to sort of have these disturbing nightmares, which coincides with the arrival of Mircalla, a.k.a. Carmilla, who is tied to an old family legend. Eventually, Carmilla and Susan begin having a relationship and taking midnight walks. And Susan becomes empowered by Mircalla or Carmilla through their relationship. And basically, they just go on a killing spree of all the men.
I love it.
Yes.
You couldn't ask for anything more in a movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or in real life.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit already when touching on the director regarding, you know, the era in which this was made and the themes that come up in this. And really, the prominent themes in this have a lot to do with degradation and oppression of women, specifically by them, you know, by the husband, but supported by the doctor and the caretaker.
Exactly.
And then we've got Susan and her sort of liberation or awakening, both sexually and spiritually, physically, mentally, all of those things. Because she's very sort of naive in the beginning. Like she doesn't, you know, she looks very young, and that's commented upon a lot, actually.
Right. Yeah, she does look incredibly. Yeah. And I think the doctor calls her very infantile, mm-hmm. and that she's locked in childhood myths and fantasies.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, I mean, you know, she has the thoughts, like I'm sure every woman does, especially, you know, on their wedding night when, in this case, she's saving herself, I guess.
Yeah.
But the first kind of dream element is her in the hotel, and she's attacked by a masked intruder, which is clearly her husband.
Right.
And she's raped. So you know she has these thoughts that haven't really fully awakened, that men are possessive and treat women like meat. And even if you're married or in a relationship, but she succumbs to that too, like on when they go to the hotel, or well, not to the hotel, but to the castle.
Yeah.
And she kind of knows what's coming, and it kind of plays out exactly like that weird fantasy that she has.
Yeah. The first time that they have sex, he rips her dress off, and it's not sensual. It's not titillating. It's violent. And that's what she either already has it in her mind that that's what it's going to be like.
Right.
And then it's just further exacerbated when Mercalis shows up and shows her, yeah, it actually is like this. And we'll get to some of the exchanges between the two of them because they're some of the best quotes in the movie. One thing I do appreciate, though, and I don't know if this was intentional, but I would absolutely love to believe that it is. Right after their first time having sex, he rips off her dress and he pulls down her panties and showing her gigantic bush. And then there's a smash cut to the gardener trimming the hedges. I was like, someone's got a sense of humor.
Yeah, you know, I didn't even notice that.
No? Okay, man, it's just me.
That's good, though.
Yeah. But
that had to have been intentional.
It has to be. I'm sure he's got a sense of humor. But other ways that he is a dick in this film, there's a lot. So it's established even before he does a lot of these things that all the portraits up in the house are all the men, like all the portraits of the female relatives are all down in the basement. It gets to a point between Susan and her husband that, you know, she can't even take a bath by herself. So she starts hiding from him. Mm-hmm. There's one scene that's kind of uncomfortable when they're out in the woods and he like grabs her off of a rock by her hair and then pulls her down and tries to force her to give fellatio.
Very caveman like, you know, yeah. Like he's just dominating this person and like literally pulling her by the hair and pulling her up a rock. Like he's standing on a boulder. It's very abusive and hard to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's terrible.
When she finally makes her way down into the basement and sees all the portraits of the other women, she notices the one of Mircalla and the face is cut out of it. Mm-hmm. And so she starts asking questions about this and finds out the myth about her and the legend of Mircalla Karstein was that she refused to take her husband's name, killed him on their wedding night because he tried to make her do indecent things. Mm-hmm. And so she is technically the titular blood spattered bride in this, even though Susan technically becomes that. So they're both blood spattered brides.
Right.
Could be plural and work and still work. But once she finds out about that, the husband, of course, has to correct her and be like, there's, you know, I don't know what you're talking about. Let me show you where the grave is. Cause she starts dreaming about Mircalla and seeing her and thinking that she's really there and like leaving a knife or a dagger under her pillow, things like that. So the husband takes her to where the grave is, opens it up, takes bones out and breaks them.
That's another like very aggressive showcase of this fucking male mm-hmm. who's like, you know, snapping femurs in this threatening manner, basically like,
yeah,
this is what happens when, you know, women like this do that. That's just, yeah.
Yeah. And, but so once Carmilla shows up, I'm going to interchangeably call her Mircalla and Carmilla because she's both
right.
in this, but her entrance into the film is one of my favorite things ever.
Oh, absolutely. It is one of my favorite scenes because it's so bizarre.
Yeah.
And I try to find meaning in it.
I can't find any. It's just there for the surrealistic dream. Like,
yeah. Cause Aranda does. His script is very heavily dream focused. Mm-hmm. I mean, you kind of recognize what's fantasy and what's dreaming and what's just kind of thought and within Susan's head. But at the same time, it's kind of hard to differentiate the two. You don't yeah. know what's real and what's not. And he pulls those quotes in the very beginning. That's, you know, from Plato that says like the good ones are those who are content to dream what the wicked actually practice, which I guess is expanded on Sigmund Freud's like interpretation of dreams.
So technically, I'm going to go on a very long side tangent here.
Okay. Is that a real quote from Plato?
It's Freud paraphrasing Plato.
Right.
So that's from Plato's Republic. And like it ties in later when Susan is drawing something and then he comes over and like draws the box right. with the line through it and is like, there's a separation of dreams and reality in here. So the thing with that quote at the beginning, you know, like you said, the good ones who are those who are content to dream what the wicked actually practice. I don't actually think that's the best quote to pull from Plato's Republic as it relates to the rest of the film because of the themes in the film. Like, yes, there is a lot of dreams versus reality in this.
Right.
But, or another part of Plato's Republic is the allegory of the cave. And that to me is what actually makes more sense in the context of this film, because Susan's reality up until she meets Carmilla is she's the one chained up in the cave, seeing the images projected on the back of the cave wall and thinking this is my reality, but then maybe occasionally turning around and seeing what's really out there through her dreams. And so, I mean, technically, those who are content to dream, wicked actually practice, doesn't really seem to fit for me. It seems more like Carmilla comes in, shows Susan the way, breaks her chains, and liberates her. Right. Even though the allegory of the cave is there's a lot more other political subtext going on there besides that. It's not just about accepting what's in front of you. There's way more to it than that. But I think that would fit better in the sense of it, especially when the husband came in and drew that thing for her and was talking about, well, here's what dreams are, and here's what's reality, and here's the separation. I'm like, this actually fits way better with that. Why did you use that quote? And it's not even Plato, it's Freud, who paraphrasing.
Right, exactly. Because the Freud quote is, the virtuous man contents himself with dreaming that which the wicked man does in actual life.
Yeah.
Very similar, but yeah, you're right. I felt like, because it is kind of implied, like when the doctor's talking to the husband at one point saying, you know, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but if you think hard enough on certain beliefs or fantasies, they could come true. You know, you'll start to believe it.
Right.
More or less kind of dreams can make people crazy, like, or belief systems. And that kind of happens like with how the ending kind of wraps up with that newspaper headline too. Like, it's kind of implying that this is what this man believed and this is the act he committed.
Yeah.
But yeah, the intro quote, as I was like looking at it, I was like, that's a strange quote to use.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot, and I'm sure that, I think these were original quotes when they're in the library and it's Susan and her husband, and they start reading from these publications that are in there where, you know, like about inherited dreams, like dreams belong to ancestors that can pop up in your mind.
It's the collective unconscious,
right?
Where like there are, you know, kind of the idea of, you know, we all share a consciousness on a spiritual level at some point. You know, you share like what the memories of your ancestors, and those manifest in dreams and things like that. This movie gets deep, y'all.
Right. Which gets us to the blood spattered bride title scene.
Yes.
Which is a dream sequence, which involves Carmilla and Susan, where Mercalla or Carmilla is basically controlling Susan to stab her husband to death over and over again with blood just
spattering up. So good.
Probably the best scene in the movie, which I get is where the title's pulled from.
Yeah.
But yeah, to go back to me trying to figure out how, when Carmilla is introduced and she's buried into the sand, sand.
Very long sidetrack there, but we're back to sand boobs.
Cause it is one of, I think it's the most captivating scene in the movie, and it's so bizarre and it throws you completely off guard because he's out there bearing this dagger that Susan's, you know, it's from Mercalla used to kill her husband. Mm-hmm. And he sees this hand sticking out of the sand. So he walks over and there's a snorkel and he digs up the body, and it's Carmilla. She's completely naked except for the rings that she has.
Yeah.
The infinity gauntlet.
Stop it.
Seriously. And I'm trying to determine what does this mean? Like, is it just something weird to throw into the movie? Is there any type of deep meaning here?
I think it's the former.
Yeah. I mean, it probably is. Like, because she does mention later on at that first night at the dinner that she loves to spend time alone in the deep, you know, surrounded by silence and her thoughts, which is why she was snorkeling.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I guess she's swept by the waves and she doesn't remember being how she was found. Yeah, it's almost like she was like searching for something or searching to get, it's just she's just planted there, I guess, to get to Susan in physical form. But
yeah,
it's just so bizarre. I love
it. Because he's just very carefully brushing all the sand off of her boobs, takes a minute to admire the boobs, and then is like, let me go get you a blanket. Of course.
I mean, Alexandra Bastetto, is that it? Bastetto. She is so captivating. She's like pulled straight from like a Jean Roland movie.
She is gorgeous.
With her lavender wrap, her features, mm-hmm. her dead-eye stare.
Yeah.
She is just so captivating.
So one of my favorite things after, you know, she shows up is there's a scene of them in like a sitting room and Susan is drawing Carmilla. And the husband's like in the background, just fucking chattering away, talking about himself and like what he's
his
interested
job.
In.
Yeah.
Here's how I keep myself busy. And they're just not even listening to them. And I'm like, I love this scene.
I love that scene, dude. That was my first, bullet point under favorite scenes.
Yeah.
Like where, I mean, first it starts off with them at the table too. And Carmela's kind of telling her like what she doesn't remember about her life. Mm-hmm. And the husband keeps pestering her and asking questions like, you don't remember? Like, where do you live? And she is so annoyed and put off by this man talking to her. Mm-hmm. And then you just cut to that scene. He's laying on the couch with his drink in hand. Yeah, I don't know what I'll do. And you could hear him in the background, but the whole focus is on the two of them.
Love it.
Favorite scene.
So good. Some other things like that come up related to, you know, him and how he treats Susan. There's a point where Carol asks Susan if she likes being hurt because she sees like how he's treating her. And she's like, oh, why would you say that? I'm like, that's not good.
Yeah. Yeah, the Carol character is really interesting. She's this 12-year-old, I guess, the daughter of the caretakers.
Yeah.
And she pretends to be older than she is, like her father mentions in the very beginning. But she plays like a key role in this whole movie.
Yes.
Like she's very observant. She's watching kind of everything that's going on. She knows the reason why the portraits of the women are taken to the cellar. She cares for these pigeons. Mm-hmm. Which almost implies like she's like a messenger because she is kind of the messenger between Susan and Carmela in a lot of ways with the dagger.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't like what happens at the end to her that much. I mean,
there's an alternate ending.
There is an alternate ending that okay. I read about. But there is, I'm just going to skip ahead and kind of
read. I mean, it. I like what happens at the end.
That's yeah, well, my obviously.
I mean, it doesn't. I don't prefer that ending, but I still like it. I like yeah. the alternate ender. I think the alternate ending is better, but I like the original ending just because of my preference for child murder.
Right. So. When it happened, I was like, oh, this is.
This, also why Eric.
Yeah, exactly. So who can kill a child? Blood spattered bride. It's all coming
every
together.
Every November, folks. Every November.
At least it's not every month or every 2 weeks.
It could be.
Yeah, it could. You have a long list.
I do.
Thousands and thousands. But yeah, at the end, she has the last line in the movie, which is fantastic. But she basically kind of succumbs to the man at the end, just kind of kneeling down and taking her medicine in more ways. But at the same time, the message that she delivers, which is, she says they'll come back, they cannot die, referring to not only Susan and Carmela, but the whole mentality and
the vengeful bride, essentially, because this right. is like, this isn't the first time this has happened, because it was hundreds of years ago that Carmela Karstein had killed her husband, not hundreds of years ago, but generations ago.
Yes. Yeah.
And so she is this sort of embodiment, and she needs to initiate the new bride and say, hate him, destroy his masculinity, all the things that she says. Oh my God, there's so many good ones.
Yeah, when she's yelling at Susan or
yeah, she like, destroy his masculinity. Your sanctuary has been ravaged. He has spat inside your body to enslave you. He has pierced your flesh to humiliate you. I mean, every single one of those.
Right.
Yes. But she's there to sort of, she is this reincarnation.
Oh, look at that.
Hello. Each sort of like new bride that comes along, I feel like it just sort of sparks this, Carmela is going to come back and repeat this cycle. So
yeah.
While they're killed at the end, but they're where they want to be, they're together, embraced as however you want to see it, as lovers or as just like one singular unit together. They're killed by the husband. Carol gets shot. And then it does this really weird cut to a newspaper headline of like, man cuts out heart. And like, he grabs, the last scene you see in the movie is like, he grabs a boob and you think like, is he going to cut off the boobs?
Yeah.
And then it cuts to the movie or the newspaper saying like, man cuts out hearts of three women. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, that's kind of silly, but it's funny that he, you know, he thinks he stopped this evil progression or whatever, this idea, but he's the one who's like going to pay the price right. for murdering these women. But yeah, like what you just explained too, that's why it's the thinking back on that scene where, you know, Mircalla Karstein's portrait has the face cut out.
Right.
And when you first see it, Carol's head sticking through yes. it. So that makes that so much more like, oh, that's so compelling.
I mean, it makes sense that her face has been cut out because now it's like, well, now Carmela is any blood-spattered bride, any woman who is initiated by her. So,
right.
Yeah, it could be any of them. So the alternate ending, we mentioned it since we're already here. We should probably talk about it. Yeah. This is available on the Mondo Macabre Blu-ray for you to watch as well. So the alternate ending. So the husband also opens a coffin after shooting it. He looks inside. He sees the blood spattered bodies, but Carol does not get shot in the alternate ending. She's hiding until the husband walks away. There's no newspaper thing. There's no cutting boobs or hearts out. Like, he basically just opens a coffin to see, like, okay, they're dead. And then he walks away. And then Carol takes the rings off of Carmilla and puts them on, versus the regular ending where when she approaches the husband, she already has the rings on.
She puts the Infinity Gauntlet on.
Stop it.
I'm just going to say, I think.
Okay.
Sorry. You know, I'm not always going to pull like Disney stuff and Marvel stuff. But I have to say that writer of Infinity Gauntlet, Jim Starlin, had to have watched The Bloodspattered Bride.
They're based on comics, so I'm assuming the Infinity Gauntlet is in the comics, right? So
isn't it
just the picture from the
So the Infinity,
are you talking about the comic?
The Infinity
writer?
Gauntlet. Yeah, Jim Starlin's the comic writer.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about the movie. See, I don't know.
Oh, sorry.
I don't know who writes those things.
Because, like, when you put the Infinity Gauntlet glove on, Thanos becomes, like, godlike. He's trying to woo, like, the Mistress of Death. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like after watching this and seeing, if you look at the rings, they're just different colored stones.
They're all separate rings. It's not like one big, like, you know, brass knuckle ring thing going on.
It looks like
it. Which would be really cool, though.
That would be cool.
Is your double feature pick going to be Infinity War?
Oh, man.
God damn it.
Well, it is now.
Stop.
No, but yeah, that I just have to throw that out there. But yeah, the alternate ending, it does sound, and I do like how this ends. You know, I don't really like how Carol kind of is killed at the end, but I know this whole thing will live on, and like
she'll be back. Carmilla is in all three of them now.
Exactly.
She'll be back, the next bride who's getting forced to give her husband a BJ when she doesn't want to and hasn't trimmed her bush in a while. And yeah, she'll be back. It's fine.
I do have to say that the ending shot where he is, you know, shooting holes into the coffin with Susan and Carmilla is, you know, it's a bit of a cowardly act of him doing that, but the blood just starts pouring out. Mm-hmm. It's such a good scene.
It is.
It's awesome to watch.
I love it. I also like when they're trying to escape two of the ruins and they're being pursued by the caretaker, and Carmilla gets stuck in a bear trap or a rabbit trap or something like that. Oh, there's a terrible scene of a fox getting killed in the skies. Sorry, I forgot to warn you.
It's a callback. I mean,
it's related, but it's rough to watch. It's real.
So. It's real. Yeah.
But she gets caught in one of the traps and Susan runs off, ends up getting the gun from the caretaker. She stabs him first and then he's down on the ground and she shoots him straight in the dick. Like, she makes a point to point right at his crotch and pulls the trigger. And I'm like, cheers, Susan.
I mean, I always love when like a woman's in type of like a slasher role, more or less, and, you know, causing fear in men. So it's, especially in this timeline, it's pretty progressive when this was made, which was obviously intended by the director. But
yeah,
that scene where she's slashing him up and shooting him twice. She shoots him in the head first, and then she like scrolls down and boom, right in the dick. I'm like, oh, this is so good. They also kill the doctor like with the dagger.
Right.
I love those murder scenes.
Yeah, because the doctor too, you know, we mentioned earlier that the other two men in this film are like the supporting dickheads and the supporting oppressors. So the doctor is basically telling the husband like, yeah, your wife's being dominated by a lesbian.
Exactly. Yeah. It's him. It's him kind of supporting the husband any way they can and just finding any fault or all the things that they believe are wrong with the woman.
Right.
And it's a terrible situation.
Yeah. I think some of my other favorite things with Susan. So I like that it's this sort of progressive liberation with her. She has these really extreme dreams at first, but things that happen in real life, sort of like at first she just kind of starts avoiding her husband, then outright hiding from him, then locking him out. Like, she goes up to the pigeon cage thing at the top, mm-hmm. and she locks him out. And there's this sort of symbolic moment of her taking the ribbon out of her hair and tying it to the pigeon and setting it free. So again, getting back to that symbolism of it not just being a messenger, but of also some kind of freedom there. You know, I love it when she shoots the guy in the dick. I'll just bring that up again just because I love it. I have so many just sort of favorite moments sprinkled throughout this. That being said, I don't think it's a perfect movie in any way, shape, or form. I think it's hard for me to pinpoint exactly what doesn't work for me. But, you know, I gave it 3.5 last time I watched it. And when I was rewatching it with commentary, I was like, I saw my score and I was like, wow, 3.5. I remember just fucking loving this movie.
Right.
And then I rewatched it and I was like, yeah, 3.5. But I don't know why I don't give it a 4 or 4.5, because it seems like a very, like, it's a child death. It's very feminist and progressive, for especially for the era that it's Spanish horror. It's bloody.
Right. Yeah. I think learning about the political climate helps to, like, you know, mm-hmm. it makes me enjoy the movie that much more. But it is a bit slow. I mean, thinking about, like, every scene, I mean, there's a ton of great imagery in it that we've already talked about, and it's spread out too. So it does keep it interesting, and I feel like every scene's kind of necessary, but I think some scenes go on a little too long, and in some cases it gets a little plodding.
Yeah. I mean, you're right though. It does feel slow, but every scene is beautiful. Like, even just a shot of Carmilla and Susan walking down the pathway at dusk, you can see her purple figure and Susan in her nightgown. And I'm just like, oh, it's beautiful. I love it. But it can get a little slow. So I can see why that might be off-putting for people. But I think you're right. I think having political context, and this is a perfect example of, you know, the people who are like, horror movies shouldn't be political. It's like, they are though.
Right.
Because you can't take them out of the context in which they're being made.
Exactly. Right. I mean, in one regard, you can look at this movie as being a product of its time, but at mm-hmm. the same time, it's kind of like a timeless piece. I mean, it's,
yeah,
you know, the treatment of women. And I mean, everybody can relate to, you know, finding, I don't know, some sort of calmness and resolve and a kindred spirit too. I mean, you could look at them at different angles and stuff, but it's, I think learning about, like, the Carmilla story and then, you know, the Franco dictatorship and stuff, it helps.
It does. It frames it a lot better for you. And I think you're right. And I think what makes movies like this so great is, also, like you said, of its time, but also timeless.
Right.
I think that's what makes these kind of movies stand out for me. And then why, when people are like, horror movies can't be political or they shouldn't be political, it's like, fine. You know what shouldn't be political? Fucking Friday the 13th. Fine. I'll give you that. Like, just, you can leave politics out of those. But, like, movies like this, when they're made in a very specific era, you can't not have some, you know, appreciation of it if you know what happened during that time.
Right. And if you look at Aranda's, like, filmography before, mm-hmm. decades before he worked on this, I mean, it's going to be political. Like, yeah. it's like a master of the craft jumping into the horror genre.
So clearly we both love it, recommend it, but also go in with some historical context of the film. Watch a short YouTube video about Franco if you need to. I mean,
yeah,
something exactly. like that. Read Carmilla. It's short. It's great. It's a beautiful story. And you know what? It predates Dracula. So take that, Bram Stoker.
Exactly. Yeah. Like Le Fanu, is that how you say it?
Yeah.
His novella is just...
It's fantastic.
It inspired everything that we know about, like, vampires in yeah. so many ways. Very subtle way.
Very subtle, yeah. It's not outright. It's not super horny. It's subtle, but it's good.
Yeah.
All right. So Lance, double feature pick.
So we talked about a lot of the Carmilla-inspired movies. Mm-hmm. My favorite that I've seen so far, I haven't seen them all, but Alucard is probably my favorite. But that's not the one I'm going to go with. I think this might be the truest form. After I've read the La Fanu novella, after watching The Blood-Spattered Bride, The Crypt of the Vampire, I think, is the truest.
Oh, the Christopher Lee one?
Christopher Lee from 1964. Mm-hmm. It's also known as Terror in the Crypt, which I think is a better suited title. Mm-hmm. Because like Blood-Spattered Bride, the hints of vampirism are very small. Like, they're just there in the background, mm-hmm. kind of. But yeah, The Crypt of the Vampire, this one's included in the Severin Eurocrypt of that Christopher Lee.
The green set. One, right?
The green one.
Yeah.
It's also streaming on Tubi. It's directed by, I'm probably going to butcher his name, Camilo Mastrocinque. It was originally going to be directed by Antonio Margheriti.
Hey-o.
But Mastro Cinque, took over, and I think he did a great job. Lee plays Count Karnstein, not Karnstein, but Karnstein.
That
in this
happens
one.
A lot in the, like, it's either Karnstein or Karnstein, either one. It's we get it.
Yeah. And his daughter, Laura, which is actually the name from the La Fanu novella, is having nightmares of killing women. The Count requests a Dr. Klaus to assist him in piecing together what an old ancestor, Sira or Carmela Karnstein, looked like, because he's worried that his daughter could be the reincarnate or possessed by this ancestor. And over 200 years ago, Carmela was convicted of murdering young Karnstein women and was crucified as a witch. And then a young woman named Luba pops up in the story, very much like Mircalla or Carmela in Bloodspattered Bride. And she's left to stay at the castle, and her and Laura develop this strange supernatural relationship. It has like these similarly strange circumstances on how the woman arrives to the castle. A lot of the sequences, they're similar as well. They intertwine dream and reality together, leaving you and the characters like not really sure what's real and what's not. It's very supernatural. There's also a portrait in Crypt of the Vampire of Carmela that was apparently painted over. So there's a lot of similarities. I think Crypt of the Vampire focuses way more on developing the love between the characters of Luba and Laura. Mm-hmm. And of course, in a PG early 1960s manner. I think it might actually pair better with Alucarda, but it works with the Blood Spattered Bride because of all the source content. And Christopher Lee is so good in it.
Yes.
I mean, as always. Yeah. But yeah, Crypt of the Vampire with Blood Spattered Bride.
I like it.
How about yours?
So if I were going to do a double with a Carmela adaptation, I agree. I think Alucarda would be great because they're so different tellings of that story that it doesn't feel like you're watching the same movie back to back. And the same with Crypt of the Vampire. Like, I feel like it's completely different in that sense. But Alucarda is probably one of my favorites. My other favorite Carmela adaptation is Blood and Roses from 1960 by Roger Vadim. That's on Cave of Forgotten Films as well, for anyone who wants to watch it. And that one is a lot slower than Blood Spattered Bride, which is why I wouldn't pair it with it. But I love that movie. It is one of the most gorgeous movies I've ever seen in my life. And it does also have some other random surrealistic moments in it as well, just like Blood Spattered Bride. There's one other I wanted to mention because I've watched it. And there's a Carmela adaptation starring Meg Tilly. It's just called Carmela. It's fine. It's not great. It's not upper tier, like, you know, Vampire Lovers, Twins of Evil, Alucarda, Crypt of the Vampire, anything like that. It's there. It's fine. It's whatever it is. But it's just weird. I'm like, oh, Meg Tilly did one too. There you
go. Roddy McDowell's in it.
Yeah. Roddy. Oh, love Roddy no matter what. But so my double feature pick. So I'm going to keep with the spirit of the original double feature. So I'm going to go with I Dismember Mama.
Oh, nice.
It doesn't fit at all. They got nothing in common with each other. I don't even think I Dismember Mama is a very good movie, but I'm keeping with the spirit of it. It's, you know what I will say about it? There is a great one sheet of this double feature. John has it. It's in his box somewhere. We haven't unpacked all of his stuff yet, but like,
awesome.
It's great. It's got that like neon yellow poster color. It's gorgeous. Mm. And like, it's even got like a little upchuck cup on it.
You're gonna have to post that.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, cool. We'll find it in the box. I mean, I'm sure I can find a picture of it online, but I'd rather show proof of life and be like, look what we have now. So, I mean, go with Lance's double feature pick. Honestly, if you actually want to watch something, I'm not recommending a movie that you should watch. I Dismember Mama isn't even, it has a very misleading title. The original title was Poor Albert and Little Annie. It's not full of dismemberment. So basically, like, Albert tried to kill his mother. And then he got locked away in an institution for that. And then he escapes with the intention of going back to finish the job. He ends up, quote unquote, befriending a young girl named Annie. She's a little young for him. I'm just going to leave it at that. Mm-hmm. And most of the movie is focused on their relationship. So it's a bit inappropriate. And it's not at all what you want out of a movie called I Dismember Mama. But I'm going with the purest pick here. I'm going with, like, this is how it was played back in the 70s. That's what I'm going with.
I like it.
Don't watch it, though. It's not a good movie.
Poor Albert and Little Annie.
Yeah. So that's it for Blood Spattered Bride. next episode, because we have three Wednesdays this month, we're going to have our Horror Gives Back recap episode.
Yeah, it's going to be a long one.
Yep. We're going to go through all of our picks for all 31 days. So that's 62 movies to cover. Actually more, because I'll probably talk about more. And so we'll have that. We'll have shout outs for all the folks who participated and donated. Thanks to everyone who's donated, because this is coming on the 2nd, but we're recording earlier, so we don't have all those names yet to thank you yet, but we will be shouting you out in that episode.
Yes.
We've got a lot of really fun movies to talk about. Lance and I have a lot of samesies this year, actually. I think at least three.
Yeah, well, I think I saw one of your haunted house ones, and I was going to watch that one too. The Japanese horror.
That's not my haunted house.
Oh, it isn't? Okay.
No, but
I still might watch. I might watch something different, but okay.
But yeah, if you do that, I mean, I can talk about it with you though, if you do pick that one. So we've got that.
Okay.
Mine is a very odd haunted house pick for what we do. Anyway, we'll talk about all that in our next episode for Horror Gives Back. And then after that, No Rules November continues with Lance's pick.
No Rules November. It's happening. So I'm gonna end 2022, because we are taking December off, everybody. We're going to have a year in review episode with Lindsay and Anthony.
Yeah, that's going to be our best of 2022 new to me movie. So no 2022 releases, because you guys, if you listen to our Fantastic Fest Third Eye episode, you know how I feel about new movies.
Right.
There's no point in me just hating on movies for an hour.
Yeah, that's the Fantastic Fest episode.
Every year. That's me just being like, I hated it. This one was okay. Anyway.
Right.
But yeah, so that's going to be in December. That'll be our one episode in December. But yeah. Before that.
Yeah, this is my last movie pick. So I'm going to end 2022 like I started it. So we had Giallo January.
Right.
And my first pick was Smile Before Death.
Oh, God.
Starring Rosalba Neri. Mm-hmm. And my last pick also stars Neri.
I am not mad at that.
Lady Frankenstein.
Hell yeah.
It's not Monster Dog. If I don't know if that's what
you were
thinking.
That's what I thought you were going to pick.
I was very close. But Lady Frankenstein, this is it. 1971, directed by Mel Wells. I think I brought this up maybe on an episode, and I might have mentioned it maybe my next pick, but I don't know, for No Rules November. Joseph Cotten plays Baron Frankenstein, who, along with his assistant Marshall, stitches together a creature using body parts supplied by grave robbers. And then they insert a killer's damaged brain into the creature's skull, bring it to life, but it freaks out and it kills Dr. Frankenstein. These aren't spoilers. Okay.
No.
And then it escapes. Frankenstein's daughter, Lady Frankenstein, played by Rosalba Neri. She wants to carry on her father's work, and she seeks out his old assistant, Marshall, to help her continue. They end up falling in love, but the assistant, Marshall, is getting old. He's aging, right? So Lady Frankenstein works to transplant his brain into a younger man's hot bod. But that first creature's still out there terrorizing the village, so you know something's going to come to a head, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Frankenstein orgy.
Yes. No spoilers though on that.
Sorry, I just spoiled it for everyone.
So yeah, it doesn't matter how many views this has, because this is No Rules November.
Yes.
There's a lot of versions out there. They're streaming on Tubi. There's an Italian version with subtitles on Tubi. There's English dub versions on YouTube. The two versions are different. The English version is a little shorter. It's about 85 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I think the Italian version's about 15 minutes longer, but either version's fine. You're not going to miss anything.
Are both on the Blu-ray?
There is a Blu-ray out there. I think it's region locked. So if you have a region free player, but yeah, it's also streaming all over the place. So Lady Frankenstein, my No Rules November pick, Rosalba Neri.
Love it.
I do too. I'm very excited. This is my last movie of 2022. Like, this will be the last movie I watch. This is it.
Oh, you're done?
Then I'm done for the year.
I mean, that's fair.
There'll be many more.
I mean, yeah, I'll probably take it easy a little bit after this. Got some writing to get done. So yeah. Which also we might have a fairly big announcement in Lance's episode too. So
yeah,
not spoiling anything yet, but we'll see.
This is going to be good.
I hope so.
It's going to be a happy holidays for everybody.
We'll see. Get some hate mail after that announcement. Maybe. We'll see.
Forward that shit to me. I'll fucking go blood spattered bride on him.
Thank you, Lance. All right. If you're not already, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter. I don't know for how long on Twitter, though. We'll see.
Mm.
We'll see. And Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd, Instagram, and Twitter for who knows how long, at Hex Massacre.
Right now, you can follow me on all these, but who knows how long for any of them, right? Yeah. Except Letterboxd.
Letterboxd,
I'll stick around on Letterboxd. I'm L. Scheibe. Same on Twitter and Instagram.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you back in 2 weeks for Horror Gives Back. And then at the end of the month, we'll be back with our next No Rules. Nope, I can't say it. Lance has to say it.
Okay, here we go. No Rules November.
With Lady Frankenstein. Night, y'all.
Bye.
It's Death by Video.
I'm Phil.
I'm Kit.
And I'm Graham, saying welcome to our podcast full of merry movie mayhem.
Ever wonder what an Irish kung fu movie would look like?
It's called Fatal Deviation, and we covered it.
Ever wonder what a movie about 1,000 cats would look like?
It's called Night of 1,000 Cats, and we covered it.
And it stars Hugo Stiglitz. Listen to Death by Video to hear us discuss and dissect some of the weirdest, wildest, and wackiest films ever made. All this and more on Death by Video!
Woo!